Yeah, so you stop being emotional about these things. A few characters you type on the keyboard should not define your self-esteem.
That should be the title of the episode.
Yeah.
The keyboard characters are not self-esteem measurement. That's a good one.
Welcome to another episode of the Concurrency Podcast. With your host, I'm Jack McLintz.
And I am Herman Kibue.
And I'm Steve Kibuka. The JavaScript developer your boss warned you about. And in this episode, we host Henry Onyango, Drew, and we talk about differences in engineering in startups and versus big tech. So we have a really good conversation, and make sure you're checking out on Twitter at @MashianDrew.
Yeah, sure. I'm really excited about this talk, actually. I'm really looking forward to it.
So today we have Henry Onyango. So I'd introduce you, but I'm going to let you introduce yourself just because I know you're going to be modest and I want to come back and reintroduce you again. So yeah, introduce yourself. Who is Henry Onyango?
Hello, I am Henry Onyango. It's weird to hear that name. I prefer being called Drew. I am a programmer by profession and I like animes and video games. I think that's about it.
Yeah, exactly. So
that's awesome. Henry, that's awesome.
Yeah, like I said, he's going to be very modest about it. So he's not going to mention he's a software engineer at Microsoft. He won't mention he was at Twigger. He was at Skyline Design. He's the co-founder of RuMetal. He's not going to mention that. So could you? Is it that you're that modest, or just because you don't like to identify yourself to things you've done?
Yeah,
I don't know if it's modesty. It's the question of like, tell me about yourself has always been a difficult one because people are complex, and everything you said is in a way a description of my job, or what was my job, and so I don't know if my whole being can be summarized as what I've done job-wise. So programming encompasses all of those things you've mentioned. And then, you know, you did mention animes, which is an important facet as well, and video games, and books, and writing, right? So it's always difficult, and it's better to elucidate more on the question through a conversation as opposed to a simple phrase. I would have done a much better description if this was a job interview, but given we're in a podcast, everything. Yeah.
Sure.
So I'm going to tell you something that these guys won't. So today in the morning we had a pre-recording call, and Herman says Henry's going to ask us what is our purpose, and we are not going to answer those questions. So apparently you like asking people what is their purpose. And so we had a consensus that if you ask us what is our purpose, you're not going to answer that question. Yeah. So don't ask us what is.
But it really helps. Remember, like, you know, most of us were looking. We were looking up to Kina Henry while we were in the hub. So, like, that would really help.
Yeah, we've actually never had that conversation of the effect that room had for all of us. I think we probably should sometime, but anyway, I'm just giving out unnecessary details. So 2 hours ago, I was in Jack's house, and immediately you get into Jack's house, there's a trophy, the most innovative student, TUK, 2021, and so apparently there are only two people who have that award, and so it is Drew and Jack. So you're the only two people. You're the only two people who have that award. So I know it doesn't mean anything to you, but then I just thought that is an interesting fact.
Jack should know I pioneered it.
Henry was not there even to collect the award. Remember,
he was there.
Yeah, he was there to pick his award, and then I think what's her name? There's your friend that went to pick it up for you, right?
Murphy.
And then there are also a couple of other presents that we misquindled before they got to you. I think there was some.
Oh really? I had no idea. Presents.
Yeah, and because what happened then was, people had to vote. Jack and I had tried rigging the votes. We had tried writing a script that could vote for us, but then it didn't work out because apparently the Google forms are very well secured, so you can't just continuously vote for someone. So,
or you guys are just bad programmers. It could be one of them. At the time, Jack couldn't write JavaScript to save his life. And Steve was deep in data science and machine learning. So,
yeah, but it was weird, Banam. Starting out.
Yeah. So, Henry, there are also a couple of things that maybe you worked on before, right? So, things, innovation, and then also entrepreneurship. You've also had some experience with that. And maybe towards the end of the conversation, kind of just going to ask about brief of your experiences with regards to that.
Yeah, sure.
So for today, I think we have a well-set topic. And the topic for today, Steve?
Yeah, just basically you giving us sort of your personal and some of what a general experience of what you've gone through in terms of the differences in engineering in startups and in big tech. And so, yeah, before we even get to that, there's always this question I like asking people who have been at dev agencies and at a startup that is building its own product. So you coming from sort of Skyline into Twigger, is there some sort of difference that you felt in terms of the engineering that was happening in both places?
Definitely. I think it's safe to mention that Skyline as a dev agency was quite different from what most dev agencies have. I think there was a lot of innovation. There was in-house products that we were also working on. We stayed much, much longer with clients. But prior to Skyline, I worked for another dev agency, a couple actually. I won't mention all of them. So maybe share experiences from, I think, Skyline itself qualifies as much as Twigger from a product perspective, just given how the company was run and the kind of products they were working on. But in regards to generally what I would say a dev agency and a product-based company, I think for me, one of the most noticeable things is speed, you know. So in a dev agency, you're working on a product for 2-3 months. You're churning it out really quickly. The goal is to get the product working, prototype it really fast so that the clients are happy and, you know, the dev agency gets paid. For a company like Skyline or Twigger, it was more of still the same speed, I guess, but with a focus more right now on the customers. So I guess the first thing is who is the customer then changes, right? For a dev agency, it's another company. For a startup, it's the users of the product. And then how long you stay with your code. So in a company like Twigger, even though the code also changes quite rapidly, at least you're working on the same code base or the same product for a minute. And you get used to it and you start to understand the nuances and the different edge cases. And working on the same product, you know, allows you to think of different ways to make it better, to tinker with it. For dev agency, it's most of the time, other than Skyline, the other dev agencies I worked at, get it working the way the client wants as fast as possible and you're done. Yeah. And that was the fast as possible was typically 2-3 months. And even 3 months is a stretch, right? Because the client was promised 2 weeks. Yeah. So now you have to get it working. Yeah, they always promised something less than a month. And then what ended up happening was
you couldn't do it, and you know, it was like one more week, and you ended up spending 2 months on the thing.
Yeah. So to just to follow on that, the question of like, you know, in most startups, you are owning like the entire process. You're the one designing the database, now designing the API. Okay, there is a front-end guy, but even the DevOps thing, you are the one like also doing that. So how would you compare that between the two? Like working, let's say in a dev agency, I think you are working on a product, like you can be the product owner of that, like a given client. So how is that different from the experience that you had with now where you are writing code internally? Like you're doing your products.
I don't even know if you're a product owner in a dev agency. Again, I want to reiterate that Skyline was a different dev agency. But for most dev agencies, you're likely just a relationship manager, right? Your work is to make sure the client doesn't get pissed off. And not so much about the product itself. Because if they leave the company, you have questions to answer. So you're more like the bank relationship manager. You know how they make sure you... So it's a lot of... One thing I would take away is it makes you good at buying yourself time, right? You get good at making people less pissed off and buying yourself more time. And for most dev agencies in Kenya, at least the ones I've seen, I don't even think things like DevOps are taken so much into account. I mean, nowadays, or when I started working, let me say that, DevOps wasn't a thing, right? And we did things on, what was it called? The PHP MyAdmin and Tomcat and weird stuff. Yeah, so DevOps wasn't a thing. Nobody worried about DevOps. And most of this stuff were just crude applications or websites. None of it ever got done to the satisfaction of the client, I might mention. All of it was always half-baked and released as quickly as possible. And then that's because you spend so much time with, very little time with the code. But for like Trigger and again, for most startups nowadays, there's a demarcation. You'd find there's a DevOps guy, there's a backend guy, there's a front-end guy. It allows you a lot more focus, a lot more innovation, a lot more breathing room. You don't need to buy yourself time, at least not as much as you buy yourself time in a dev agency. My experience with dev agencies wasn't that good, to be honest. Like outside of Skyline, most of them weren't that good. The things clients were promised, you're never part of the first meeting. You only brought a brief and you're told you make the website dance. We were writing code in CodeIgniter. There was no Django or Angular or React. There was only CodeIgniter and Laravel. And Material CSS has just started coming up. And Bootstrap, which people nowadays don't even use anymore.
When is that? But it's sounding like the start of tech.
that was like when iHub was just starting out, because I remember I got my first job in 2014, right? When I was still in second year, I started working.
That's a bit of experience, huh?
I mean, back in the day, not that many people are programming. Nowadays, everybody's learning code. But...
Yeah, sure.
We were rare breed.
So, Henry, also just emphasizing on this story of ownership, right? So you've had experience, let's say, from a startup perspective, kind of just starting up a few people building a product, and now to a big organization. And the issue of ownership now comes in whereby, let's say, we sometimes have startups that grow or kind of get acquired by, in quotes, big tech, right? And you find something whereby in a startup, let's say it's 2-4 people starting up, you build something and you're the developer and you kind of own the thing that you're building, right? And then later other people get brought in and then they want to now, maybe you are the sole developer, now you've been brought a product manager who wants to change this to something. but then it's like, this is your baby. You knew what you wanted for it when you started. Yeah. Why are they trying to make it into a child that is not yours, right? So what has been your experience from both aspects on a startup, on ownership of what you're doing, and also in big tech, where I think it's more of a, you were given a small, let's say, a spoke in a wheel. You're kind of just making sure the spoke is right, kind of, right? It might be a very big product with very many people working on the same thing.
I mean, first it was a struggle. I'll start from there, especially because for me, I started working while I was a bit young. And I was very emotional about my code. Forget the product, the code that you wrote. And someone coming and saying it's spaghetti and Micha,
you're not understanding that.
Yeah, my friend Micha had a tendency of telling me how much I was writing spaghetti code, but it worked. I'd spend endless nights on it, and there's no way you're deleting it. I struggled a lot. I would say I matured in Skyline. I don't know if it was an age thing or if it was a function of just working with like brilliant people to a point you recognize the brilliance. But in the beginning, that idea of ownership, and even in big tech, I think ownership is a mindset. And while I agree with you that if you're working for a big organization, of course you can't own, as an individual, you can't own the entire product and the different people who are looking into it. You sort of, if you force yourself or if you have the right mindset around, and this is something that even in say Microsoft, it's highly encouraged. The idea of thinking of it like your own, right? Being like some sort of intrapreneur and you're thinking of that product on your own. And so you might not even be part of that team, but if you have ideas on how to make that product better, how to improve on that code base, you're only giving out those suggestions. So the fallacy that for big organizations, there's no ownership, I think it's a lie. It's fallacious. But in startups, of course, you have a lot more autonomy, I guess, in a way, of your code base. And because if you're being honest, again, for most startups, nobody's checking your code, right? So you might be having autonomy of garbage, but at least you own it.
autonomy of garbage.
In the beginning, it was a struggle. It was a struggle to think. And I think part of it was ego. Part of it was being young and immature. Part of it was thinking you're the best programmer. Over time, you meet brilliant people and you meet people who, it's factual that they're better than you. And so if that person is saying you need to refactor your code or we need to change the product this way, will you let your ego come in the way of making something better, right? And learning. So you mature with time after a while. You stop being emotional about your code and your product.
Okay. So by the way, do you think people should write tests to their code? Steve does not write tests.
Steve Kibuka doesn't.
But then, I'm going to say this. And I know my PM listens to this, but I'm not paid enough to write tests.
No, but then you're not paid enough to do anything really, right? You're not paid enough to write code and you're not paid. Let's start with the testing thing, right? Testing is a very subjective thing. And when I say subjective, you know, some people will tell you you have to have unit tests. I mean, you're writing APIs to fetch what? The shoppings that were done. Is it? Testing is a function of the feature that you're writing and how important it is and what it is that you want to guard against. I personally do not think you should write tests for everything because, again, maintaining them. Because maintaining them and I don't think you should write tests for everything, to be honest, because
maybe on the front end side.
No, I mean, even on the back end side, it's not like every time you're doing. Look, you've been coding for what, 5 years, writing cloud applications and reading from a database. You've done it a thousand times. You're sure it works. There's no complicated logic that you want to make sure you're defending against, right? Now, yeah. What I would say is, say in the front end, I think at least write end-to-end test, right? Because that one, you're sure that you're not breaking any experience. Have enough integration tests so that you know your components are working together. I mean, if you want to write unit tests, it depends. Unless you have some complicated function, you know, you're writing a function to do some miracle thing. Because again, you write unit tests for pure functions or for pure... Your code has to have some sort of purity, right? So you have side effects and you're busy writing unit tests. What's the point? What's the point? You struggle.
But then also, you can think of it in terms of, because I have a friend who normally is also pro unit tests. He does a lot of unit tests, right? So this one time we had this conversation, he was like, the only reason I invest in unit tests because I have trust issues. And I work with other people. I'm part of that friend. I also have I'm also like the same opinion. Might be I have trust issues, right? So I'm doing this function here, and maybe we are 2, 3, 4 people working on the same piece of code, right? How do I make sure that the other person does not make changes that affect my functionality that I did? Or maybe this person can be me 3 months later, who went to another project and then came back, and then now.
But then there's also, I get that, and I think I agree with that, because that also helps in documentation. If I was coming and going through your code and I go through the test, I'm very quickly able to understand what the function does, right? But too many tests, and then there's also the aspect of like false positive. Like, how do you know your test is not wrong, right? Yeah, now you have too many of them.
If you have many tests, I think iterating or adding a feature needs, and it is breaking some parts. I think in a startup, the moment they are requesting a feature tomorrow for test, I think people go like in a bad direction with that.
Yeah, and also if you are being like completely honest, it's also a function of who's on your team, right? I mean, like,
yeah,
it's also a function of who's on your team, right? If you know the person is going, I don't think unit tests for everything is important, to be honest. Maybe make it a 70-80% coverage if you have to write them. But also pick out what's... Let's look at front end, for example, right? Like, why would you write a test to confirm that a button is green, unless being the button being green is an important feature? But what's the point? Right, like, because I've seen tests where people write tests that don't even add value, right?
Yeah,
you're testing that your component does what, for example. You're testing that an input changes text. It's nice, especially when you're starting out testing. It's nice, but is that the important feature in that search box there, right? We know an input is always going to update the text, right? And if you're writing React and you can't be 100% sure that you're controlling the input and updating the text, then I don't know, maybe stop writing tests first and then figure out the React part.
For sure.
Okay.
So Henry, you lean towards the front end side more, or do you do back end nowadays or something?
So I also stopped demarcating myself, right? Programming is programming. I solve problems. That's what I do. And if that problem requires me to write backend, I'll write backend. If that problem requires me to do frontend, I'll do frontend.
So you do not believe in being like a specific in what you do? Like you just focus on one area?
There's what I believe and then there's what happens, right? Obviously, you're never going to be truly full stack. I think programming is too wide for you to be like expert mastery at embedded hardware and backend and front end, but the underlying principles and concepts are the same, right? And languages are tools and programming is a tool. And once you understand how to, for me, the important thing is being able to solve problems. I've been using GitHub Copilot for about a month plus now, and I'm not lying, right? I think there'll come a time when you don't write code. That thing, the moment I start writing and I press tab, it's done. So do you understand the problem and are you able to break it down enough to smaller pieces that can be solved is what programming is, and not so much fights between JavaScript and Python, which one is the better language. And believe me, we had those fights for what, 3-4 years with Micha, between Java and Python, which one is better, and Ruby and Python, which one is better, because Micha was always a Python guy. But after a while, you realize it doesn't matter, right? Whether you write it in PHP or Packet, doesn't matter. The most important thing is, are you able to understand the problem? Can you break it down? Do you have the underlying principles enough for you to be able to start writing code? And we have no code tools nowadays. If you've used GitHub Copilot, then you know that day is coming. I hardly write full functions nowadays. I'm not going to lie. Combine that thing with TypeScript and type inferences. Yeah, once you write a comment and you're thinking through your code and you start function, add number, everything is there and you only need to press tab. And that's what, after a year. Now I can imagine the next 5 years. I don't think people would be. Imagine Herman, how many times you've written CRUD application that you've
written
a thousand times. What's the point?
So it would be just add a comment. You just add a comment and then you just hit tab.
Yeah, I mean, the most important thing is identifying the endpoints, identifying the logic, identifying the problem you're trying to solve. Writing code to read from a database is you know, you can Google it. It's not that novel. There's nothing magical you're doing.
I also think the chunk of the time comes when you're that initial setting up that initial solution, that is when I think for me, that is where I spend most of my time. And so for me now, GitHub Pilot coming in and giving me that initial rough solution that I can start to work with, it speeds up my time really.
I like that he's called it GitHub Pilot, right? It's actually GitHub Copilot.
Oh, Copilot, Copilot.
The way I've been using it, I feel like I'm much more of the Copilot than the pilot. Nothing writes better code. Nothing writes better code, right? Maybe I'm the co-pilot in this sense.
Actually, Bana. And I think also the code generation in Go side. I think nowadays you don't write like the CRUD operation and stuff. You just design your field, your database and its field. And then there is a package for that. It just generates the CRUD operation for it. So, yeah.
Nice.
I can't relate.
CRUD is CRUD. Yeah, obviously, you know, you're a sage. Who does C++, if you're being honest?
Yeah, so we were talking about ownership earlier, and so just sort of now focusing on the kind of work you do at Microsoft, could you just describe for us sort of the depth and the breadth of ownership that you particularly have and on the product that you're working on?
An interesting one, So I'm part of the search core team. And basically what that means is, I think first I should say, my opinions are my opinions and they're not a representation of Microsoft. So, you know, that should be very clear.
Somebody disclaimer.
Should go and quote Microsoft on the things I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yes, but I'm part of the search core team, and what we work on is, you know, if you look at office.com or you look at Outlook, the search box that you see there, yes, that small little piece there. Or you go to Teams, the whole M365 suite, anytime you see a search box, in one way or another, there's something my team did there. Now, ownership-wise, I have always been a meddler, right? I like getting my hands on too many things and trying to see if I can have an impact and influence. So A, I don't know if I'm like the best specimen from an ownership perspective, because for me, I think of the whole search as my baby, and how can we improve it, and how can we make it better, and how can we, you know, get into other products of Microsoft as well. So I think of it, you know, I know we have like a product owner and someone at the top who's responsible for it. I think of myself as that person as well. Right? So as I write code, I think of the bigger picture. But from a day-to-day perspective, again, my team is one that encourages you to be innovative and to give suggestions and ideas. But on the very least, you're expected to own a feature, right? You're expected to be, you're given a feature or you discover a feature, and you're supposed to work with the designers and the product managers to make sure that that feature is fully fleshed out and it's been implemented. And you're working, collaborating with other people, not just yourself. And so it's yeah. not so much of an individual ownership and a bit more of a team ownership. But while I was in Twiga, I used to be part of the SRE team, the site reliability team, which I think majority of the time are doing DevOps stuff. And so my work was primarily building dashboards for, quote unquote, trying to visualize some of these DevOps things. Like that, I say building dashboards. I only built one. I wasn't there long enough to add an S to that dashboard. But I owned the entire thing, right? And I collaborated with the designers and the product managers to try and get it all the way from idea to implementation. So there's a lot more that you can own from a startup, right? You're given a lot more responsibility, and there's a lot more expected of you. Not to say that in a big organization you don't get the same things, but there's many people are working with you, right? And so the resources are much more. So you have, while you can still, you know, be a meddler and put your hands on many things, the expectation is that there's a lot more people to help you out.
So that brings the question of depth versus breadth in between the two, in a big tech and let's say in the startup. What I've realized is, let's say you are working on the search, so you have a depth in that, right? You have a breadth in the entire product, you understand everything, but you are a specialist at something in a given product. So I think in a startup, that is not possible in any case.
Okay. I try not to speak in absolutes, right? Because saying something is not possible or that can, again, it depends on who you are as an individual, right? And while in a startup, because it's fast paced, you're always churning out features. There's a lot more that you're handling. You end up, you know, having a lot more breadth. You can decide to have depth, and there's an opportunity. And I think it's even encouraged for you to have depth, right? You could be the guy that people go to for testing, for example, right? You could be the guy that people go to for JavaScript. So it's individual. I don't think the idea that you don't get depth in a startup. I used to believe that, right? I used to hold the opinion that a startup will not allow you to have depth. And to some degree, that's true, because the workload is quite a lot, right? It's manageable, but it's quite a lot. And so if you're not someone who breathes code day in, day out, you might miss out on the depth. But there's still an opportunity for you to gain them. I think it's just an individual and what you perceive as important. Yeah. When I was younger, the only thing I was doing was code. I think you guys knew I had my laptop everywhere.
with an external Wi-Fi antenna.
Yes, nowadays I can't fool all nighters anymore. I'll need 2 days to recover. but if you're someone who's you really want depth, a big company would offer you more depth because you're working on one thing long enough for you to be bored and start thinking the deeper questions, right? Because you start wondering what's the best way we can optimize this thing? Is this really how far it can go? And you find yourself reading about, you know, browser engines and the difference between V8 and Chakra and why we went to V8 and how to optimize your website and make it, you know, faster and faster. But for a startup, it's more of getting the product on the hands of the users. So sometimes you might end up not gaining a lot of depth because, you know, whether it's at 95% performance or at 80%, does it work well enough for the users is the question that is usually being asked.
Sure.
So, like, is it easy, let's say, from your experience in a startup where we say it's more of a breadth because you have a lot of these things? At times you find that you're trying out things in a startup, right? So let's say you are trying out this particular part, but then you also have a fallback. If this does not work, I'm also learning this as an alternative, right? And so you're kind of like not an expert in it, right? And you also have a lot of time doing research on that. But then working in a kind of a large organization like you are, you'll find that you said you also have breadth, right? But now it becomes kind of easier. So to say, like, let's say I want to do X, but then there's somebody who's good at that X that you want to do. So how easy is it
that's an overlooked part, right? I didn't think about that, but now that you mentioned it, I think it's an overlooked part of depth. I think also, if you're being honest, right? Like, say you work at Google or Microsoft, right? You might, and you're an Android developer and you work at Google, for example, right? You might have access to the person who wrote the camera API. And so if you wanted to learn more about the camera API, there's that ability for you to, you know, set a sit down with him, and maybe there's something you're working on, and, you know, he'll give you the resources, the guidance and the materials for you to go deeper into it. But also there's also the idea of time, right? Because you might work on a feature, you know, Google or Microsoft or Netflix, I don't know, but you might be working on a feature and it's going to be launched in 6 months. So you have a lot more time with your code base and thinking about whether that's the best approach. Because again, the highest code quality matters because it's money, right? If you introduce a bug, it might cost millions, if not billions of dollars. And so you have enough time for you to really question efficiency, quality, depth. While, you know, the pace in a startup is much, much, much faster. And so every week you're fixing a bug and you're releasing a feature. And for the, I would say for the average developer, if you don't make your own personal time, it might be too much for you to also try and gain depth at the same time.
So just to expand, since you've also mentioned that it's easy to get access to the person who wrote, let's say, this API that you want to use for the platform that you're working on, right? So my question would be like, how easy is it? Let's say I'm doing this, and is it also applicable to reach to someone for your on-site project related thing? Not related.
First, let's define what do you mean by side project. Like, let's start from there.
Okay, let's say you have a hobby project. You're working on something on the side that's just your side.
And it's a hobby project, right?
Yes, and you're using this platform, but you know from work, I have access to the person for me.
Yeah, then you ping them and you say, hey, I'm working on this thing. I know that you wrote XYZ. You know, would you set aside some 1 hour to have a discussion on it? And they're very happy and willing to do it. So, yes. And pinging them in Teams is different from pinging them in LinkedIn, right? They might never respond in LinkedIn, but in Teams, they will likely highly respond. So it's much easier.
So it's more of like, let's say, a kind of in quotes, a friendship conversation. Like, okay, I want you to help me with this. Are you willing to do? Rather than having set channels. But I'm sure let's say if it's a work-related thing that you need help from another team who build that, it has to be like a channel there.
Definitely, if it's a work-related thing, they're going to make time. But even in my personal experience, even your own stuff, just learning, forget even a hobby project, right? You just want to learn how GitHub Copilot works. You'd be surprised. They're usually very accessible and very happy to help out. And you ping them, you reach out to them, and they're very open to... Everybody's excited to talk about the things they built and worked on. I think every developer is excited to do that. And I've not seen an instance where you reach out to them and they're like, you know, nope.
Can I send you a list of questions and people to reach out to with those questions?
I mean, they will answer me and then I will ghost you. There's that, right? No, but Sure. Also, personal initiative. Why don't you build a relationship with them on LinkedIn and cold email them, and try and see.
Like you said, in LinkedIn, it's easy for them to ignore.
I'm saying the chances of them ignoring are higher, right? It's LinkedIn. Maybe they don't even use it. Okay. By the time someone builds something like the camera API, they're likely a principal or a distinguished engineer. A distinguished or a principal engineer does not, in my opinion, care about LinkedIn. The recruiters will find them. And most of us use LinkedIn to find jobs, let's be honest, and connect.
For sure.
Those people are not on LinkedIn. That's just the truth. Best case scenario, maybe find them active on Twitter. Someone like Kenzie Dots is very active on Twitter and very willing and likely to help. But if you're working in Remix, I am sure it's easier to access Kenzie Dots than you reaching out on Twitter. So, I mean, that's the reality, right? They see you as a colleague. They already know there's a level of trust that being a colleague accords you. So it's much easier for you to have access to those people.
Yeah. So speaking of the accomplished people, with the experience that you have, how would you define the things that are, how would you describe an efficient developer, a good developer? Because while starting, the good developer was always the nerd, someone who is not communicating, just on a machine. With the experience now.
So Jack. You mean Jack and Micha?
I've not mentioned, man.
We are going to sue for defamation.
Yeah.
My definition of being a good engineer has changed over the years. In the beginning, it was someone who has deep, deep technical knowledge, always on their computer, and, could hack stuff. But right now, I think three things matter to me, or I've noticed three things. The first one is your ability to communicate. So not just around your work, but around your ideas and innovation, getting people to buy into your ideas. The second one is, because even code itself is communication, right? So even writing good code means the person who's coming next after you can read your code and clearly understand without
programming languages.
Right? Yeah, without going to the test, they can understand what your code does. Of course, a deep understanding of technical knowledge, I think is still there. Somebody who understands or has a good enough formula of how to learn. One of the things I've noticed, especially working in Microsoft, is that senior engineers or principal engineers are not scared of saying, "I don't know." Right? You can ask them a question and they say, "I don't know." And I've come up with this theory that part of the reason why they're not scared of saying, "I don't know," is because they know if they have to learn it, they can learn it very quickly and very efficiently. And so they're very confident in not knowing. And they're able to distinguish what is important and what is not. So that ability to be able to pick up something and learn it effectively, quickly, is something that I think, for me, ranks highly. Because programming languages are tools, frameworks are tools, and they're always changing. But can you learn it effectively and quickly? And also having empathy, right? Being able to understand people and deal with people. Right, because you're never working in a silo, you're always going to be collaborating. And even if you're building your own product, you're building it for users. So being able to put yourself in other people's shoes and understand them. And you'll notice, the higher you go, I think the less your technical abilities matter less. And the more your ability to be able to break down problems, communicate, understand people, learn matters more than going and reading the entire Python documentation.
Data shit.
Yeah, but I mean, in the beginning, you kind of have to, right? I'm not saying that you don't have a deep technical knowledge, because again, the people I'm saying really, really understand their craft and they have a high degree of mastery, right? but they also know. Maybe someone is really good in JavaScript and you ask them a TypeScript or a Python question, they're not scared of saying, I don't know, right? But they can figure it out if they have to. I think it's different from what I see with us, right? But with us, it's, we've taken fake it till you make it to a different degree, pretending like you know everything and hiding under bravado words and, yeah. Big jargon, sure. That if you're asked to explain, you would never explain it to a six-year-old.
Yeah. And actually, if you've realized, when you are like reading an overview of something, let's say you want to learn a new technology, let's say Docker. When you are reading the overview, like, it is very, very easy. But the moment you write your first like code or something or integration, it is breaking. And from there, you just give up. So you can really hide from the big names, like the names in the industry. But the actual implementation is the most important thing.
I've never used Docker. I really don't get the big hype around it.
Like, yeah, like, okay, you can do, like, I was giving an example of learning something new.
Yeah, but like, yeah, I know, but I'm asking, what's this Docker thing? Like, why is it important? Like, why is containerization important?
So, just before Herman answers that, I saw this kind of meme where it was like, initially it used to be, it works in my computer. Now the programmer says, let's ship your computer. So now Docker was now the virtualization of that. Let's ship it with your computer that it works. Yeah.
So that's the use case. And this is me asking from an
ignorant perspective. How do you use Docker?
What I would say, like, the most important thing with Docker is like a seamless like flow from, let's say, the code in your machine to the code in to a production code now, that the one that is being used by the clients. You find like while developing, let's say, I would say about Django, and you are not containerizing anything. So first of all, you are running on debug and those things. So they are aiding a lot in ensuring like it is easy to start and have the first endpoint. But when you give that code now to someone who is going to host it, again, they must go into your settings file and start doing like all the things. And maybe you are developing on a Windows machine. So for some commands, yeah. But you find like in a production environment, you are using, like, no pun intended, Henry.
Wow.
In a production environment, you are using Linux and they have now to do some changes. But with Docker, you just ship it. The way you ship it from your computer is the way it is going to work in a production environment. So I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah, it sounds like I'm still not going to use Docker.
Maybe just ask the question. What is the difference between now Docker, let's say in Python, from the little experience I've had with it, is a virtual environment, right?
Yeah.
So is it the same thing? Kind of just creating an environment where all your things, so if somebody has that environment, kind of like shipping your code plus the production, the environment you used to develop it.
Yeah. So if I get you correct, like a Docker is like, you see the joke that you have given, like if you have, it is working on your machine, take your machine and push it to production with your machine. So that is the case. If it is working inside a Docker, so Docker is just like the machine, but now it is now, how would I say it? Like it is not like heavy because it is using the entire like, it is different from virtualization, in that in virtualization, like you need to add like a, like the way you have in our Windows again, like the guest, and then now you're having a couple of them. But now in Docker, they are sharing the host, and then now you are just shipping in the structure of the OS on top of that.
Sounds very complicated.
Yep.
Yeah. So because we're talking about Docker, and earlier you had mentioned something about DevOps and the way you did PHP MyAdmin stuff earlier. And yeah, every time you mention PHP, Jack smiles just because he has a relationship with PHP. Anyway, so now the work that you sort of have done, both at Twiga and at Microsoft, so sort of the differences in the DevOps pipeline and how things got to production. So could you speak more on that?
I mean, Twitter has a very robust DevOps system. Like, there's an entire team that is dedicated to that. If I remember correctly, they're on GCP. And you know, they that whole idea of you take it from your local host to a staging environment, it's tested in the staging environment. I think they had like two staging environments and then you push it to production. Now take that and multiply it by 1,000, right? And then you get Microsoft.
I like that.
There are teams, not one team, there are teams dedicated to making sure that the pipelines run smoothly and they're fast and testing are not flaky, and you know, every tool that is used is in-house and proprietary. It's more. And you know, you don't just ship things to production. It might take a while for your code to see production. It has to go through layers and layers of testing and approvals and more testing, part of which includes like an A/B test just to make sure that there is value in the things you've written. Is there an improvement from the customer standpoint? And there are people who are dedicated to reading this, to making sure that this test, whether they're A/B test or, you know, just normal end-to-end or unit test, run well. The people were dedicated to reading the results and trying to tweak it and optimize it and see what went wrong, what went right. It's fun, really. You know, it's bigger. It's way bigger because security has to be of the highest code and the highest degree. Your code cannot have any vulnerability. Your code has to work well. And then, so there are multiple layers in Microsoft that you have to go through, and it might take a while for you to actually see your feature in production, even if it's a bug fix. It's not just, you know, in Twiga, 2 days your feature is there and you can test it, you know, 3 days max. It's in the user's hand and you're testing it. In Microsoft it takes a while. It takes a long while. Merging your code does not mean it's in production. It takes a while.
So it also means that your code may never also make it to production.
Yeah. And you stop being emotional about it when, you know.
That's why you call the self-esteem.
It's not really, if you think about it, it's not, because it's only code, right? And if you're part of, like what you said, part of being a good engineer, understanding why it didn't make it to production and making sure that as you work on the next feature, those things are taken into account. If that makes any sense. Right? So maybe your code regresses the experience for the users. So then before you start developing a new feature, how do you make sure that this is not going to regress the experience for the users? But that's not to say that in Twiga your code might not make it to production. In Twiga as well, it might not. Right? It's just, I think, look, once you're part of a team, your code might not make it to production. That's the reality. And a team is just two people. Once you're two people, do you know how much of my code never made it to production because of Micha?
For sure.
A huge chunk never made it to production because of Micha. And we were only three or four, and it never made it to production.
Yeah.
So you stop being emotional about these things. A few characters you type on the keyboard should not define your self-esteem.
That should be the title of the episode.
Yeah.
Keyboard characters are not self-esteem measurements.
That's a good one.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at things for what they are, right? Your work as a programmer is to solve problems and create value, right? And depending on the team you're in, the value you're creating differs. For example, if you're in an SRE team, your value is to make sure that other engineers can run their code faster and have a better experience deploying their code. And so if your work is not doing that, then I mean, if your ego is really hurt, then sit down and ask yourself, you know, am I really solving problems and adding value?
For sure.
And you'll notice you're not, right? The only reason your code will not make... So do we ship bugs because now you have a fragile ego? No.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I have one last question. Maybe not the last even. Bro, how much of your work is open source?
Like how much open source stuff do I work with, or how much of the things I do are open source?
How much of your work is open source? How much open source do you contribute to as part of your work?
On a personal initiative, right? And again, these things are all subjective, right? Personally, I try as much as possible to contribute to open source if I get the time. But for my work level, there's no, at least in my team, there's no expectation for me to contribute to open source. We have learning days. We have days that are dedicated specifically for you to learn new tools, learn new technology. And you can use those days to contribute to open source and work on things that you find exciting and interesting that are outside of your normal day-to-day. But we also, you know, employ a lot of open source work, or we depend a lot on tools that are open source from a programming perspective to get our work done. Now, how much I contribute, that's a personal initiative for me. I used to be a lot more active. I'm trying to get back into it. There's a tool I use, an app I use, it's called Todoist. They have a lot of open source stuff. And, you know, I like the app, I like the tool, and I'm trying to contribute to it. But yeah, there are people whose work primarily revolves around open source. From the things we work on perspective, all our work or in our team, all of that is proprietary, right? So there's nothing out to the public. I don't think you'll find our code base anywhere. all of it is proprietary.
Yeah, I think for me, that was also just a reminder. You once left a comment in one of my open source projects and then you never came back.
What did they say?
No, you were interested in doing a task, Tusomeni. So I maintain a website called Tusomeni, and there were a couple of issues there, and then you came and you commented whether you could do it, and I was like, yeah, sure. And then you never came back.
But you see, like, open source is also like the work of God, yeah? It's charity work. I can comment and never come back. It's passion. It's passion work. So maybe I got busy. I don't know. Could also be that you never reached out to see if I can fix it. But there's a period here that I had been swamped. I was working on juggling a lot of things. But I'm trying to get back into the whole idea of open source and contributing to open source. The thing with open source is because it's free, kind of takes a back burner, if that makes any sense. Regrettably so. You don't feel the pressure to deliver on it immediately. But I'll try and structure my time better so that I contribute a lot more. Because I think it's an amazing way for you to learn and get feedback. And also get experience and even land jobs, right? Because there's a tool I contributed to called Flow, which helped me to learn a lot about static typing and was made it easier for me to understand TypeScript. But my code base and the changes I made was also mad. And I'm not talking about like changing documentation. No offense if you change documentation. I change actual code. and over 100,000 people are using it before they quasi close down Flow, because now they're only maintaining Flow for Facebook. In a way, I feel like that sort of, because you can add it on your resume and you say you contributed to this, and you know a million people use it. It adds to your repertoire of work you've done. I think it's a good way for you to learn, gain experience, but also improve on your resume and your standing.
Nice, for sure. So, Henry, to understand that you write, so under which platform do you do that?
I used to blog in Medium. Yeah. Again, for me, writing is like catharsis and a way for me to release. Someone offered for me to, like in Medium, there is mini blogs or mini platforms where you can contribute to. And someone was like, you know, could you write and we'll give you money. And I think one of the lessons I've come to learn over time is have something you like doing that doesn't involve money, right? Because if everything in your life is all about money, when money enters the equation, it's really difficult. So I write for fun. I don't necessarily write technical things. I write to help me think. I write to serve as a memory for how I thought at that time. Most of the time, my writing is around philosophy, business, money. Every once in a while, code. But yeah, my style of learning code is different. I don't need to write, because I know some people actually learn better when they, you know, they learn something, they blog about it, they learn way better. I don't need that. That's not how I learn.
So I have a private blog. Yeah, I have a private blog, and I once shared it with someone, and they told me they like how I write. But then I shared with them your blog, and they're like, "Nah, you have your own way with words that just make sense." So I think we are going to share your blog in the show notes.
I write how I talk. I write like I'm talking to myself. It's true. I don't structure it. I don't proofread. I write and then I publish. I never proofread. And it's interesting because I don't go back to read my work that often. Sometimes I scroll and I'm like, oh, so this is how I was thinking then. And life is so malleable, and you grow and you experience things and your perspectives and opinions change. It's always interesting to go back and see how you thought at a certain time. There's one point in life I thought success was a function of hard work. You know, hard work is, luck is opportunity meeting hard work. Yeah, that's a lie. At least I no longer believe that. I think I've come to learn about luck, just random luck playing a function in it as well. So it's interesting to see the different snapshots of where your life was at any given moment. And for heavy things, I journal. I don't publish them. Those ones I journal. Mm-hmm. But for things I feel like
don't want to trend.
Not necessarily. It's just as you write, you clear your head. And once I have the solution, it's nobody's business.
Sure.
When you're struggling with your stuff, nobody doesn't need to know.
So most people, I think the other day there was this conversation on Twitter of what devs would like to do at the very end of their life, where now you cannot, like, you don't want to engage with dev anymore. So most people say farming. I'm thinking yours is philosophy, just because you just sit and spit wise words.
No, I think I'll code until I die, but for fun.
For sure.
Yeah, let's start with that. But I'm also interested in literature. I'm interested in law. I'm interested in finance. I'm interested in philosophy. Look, I came to learn. I'm interested in a lot of things, and there's nothing I can do about it. And if I have an opportunity, I would like to experience and learn all those things. Different languages, that would be nice. To be able to speak multiple languages. I want to learn Norwegian, to learn German. To learn Dutch, I think they're interesting languages. So towards the end, I'll be mainly coding just to show hopefully my family, you know, kids, God willing, that they're not all that. Maybe, but the new languages will be there, and JavaScript will be so old, and it will be like PHP, my admin, and like back in the day, you know, I'll be like, Jack, everybody's moving to Rust, but he's stuck in C++. Just to show them. But I don't think I'll ever stop coding, to be honest. Even when I started coding, I had no idea it was a job. It's different from you guys now. You guys started coding and you knew there's a job at the end of the tunnel with this thing. When I started coding, I didn't know that people were paid to write code. I thought it was interesting. And plus, you could open up the terminal and then your friends thought you were a hacker. That was fun. And then in second year, I learned that people get paid to write code, and I was shocked. One thing I think we didn't mention, at least given, you know, today we want to talk about big tech and startups. The most noticeable difference that nobody ever talks about is the size of the code base. The code base in a big company. There are places I've never touched and I don't think I ever will. I consume functions I might not even know how they work. The intricate details of how they're written. So the code base is more often than not for big companies, you end up with a monorepo. And for smaller companies like a startup, you end up with different repos for different things. Code bases are big. Yeah. With a lot of legacy code.
Thank you for that. Thank you for the add-on.
Interesting. Yeah. So now concluding. We normally have this session, so we have two things left. One is I ask you some questions and you give us short answers for them.
And so like a rapid fire thing. I don't know if I have short answers.
No, we take any answer. We take any answer from this. And then Steve will do what he does best at the end of the podcast.
Yeah.
So number one, Henry. Drew. If you had to go back and redo or kind of like make changes to one college course that you took, which one would it be? Or if you had to teach it better?
One logical course.
Yes, one kind
if
of
I had to change one,
unit,
course
one that unit that you took it. Yeah, in campus. Or if you had to teach it better, which one would it be?
Calculus, man. Calculus.
Interesting.
Both one and two, all of them.
Problems of engineers.
What was the problem with it? Second question.
Like, what was the problem with it? That's the second question.
The way it was taught. Yeah, the way it was taught.
You see, right now I'm interested in like declarative and imperative programming and functional programming and those stuff. And that stuff is pure math, especially the calculus bit, right? Functions of something, derivations. While we were doing it, to be honest, I didn't understand what was going on. I didn't see why we were doing it. I think I would start by first relating calculus to life and programming maybe in work or even engineering in general. Calculus is so important, but the way it's taught like your addition. You know, 1 + 1 is equals to 2 in primary school, and nobody explains to you why it's 2. And you just know it's 2. Yeah, not to mean that it was taught bad, I think I'll just relate it better. Yeah.
Okay, so next, number 3. Camel case or snake case?
Camel case every day, man.
Yeah.
For sure.
Snake case is for snake.
Finally. Finally. What is one life hack that you think everybody should know?
That there is no life hack.
I like that.
You just ruined this for all the guests that are going to come before you, and the ones that came, before you, and the ones that will come after you.
No, like he said, he has a lot of code that never made it to production. If this is code, this is going to be one of them.
a good one. Cut.
The cut and the snip. Okay, so Steve.
Do what you do best.
So I would have loved to have like a really good dad joke for this one. But just because Drew is here and he's philosophical, I'm just going to do this one for him. So what do you call a belt made of watches? It's called a waste of time.
Nice one. Oh, God. Oh, that is dumb. That is dumb. Oh, my God. I'm going to use that one.
We can never disappoint.
Yeah, never. He puts in a lot of work in these jokes.
Probably googled that one. No way he came up with it.
At least he put in work to come across it.
And then he appears somewhere generating random dad jokes, taking it random dad jokes.
Steve, that can be an open source project.
Oh, for random dad jokes.
if you're doing that project, do it with GPT-3. Please do not have a whole repository of jokes that you've manually written.
Definitely GPT-3.
Okay. Yeah. As closing up, Henrik, thank you for showing up, having this conversation. Life hacks.
Thank you, Henry Banner. I've learned a lot.
Thank you.
And growing.
Okay.
Catch you on the next one.
Bye.
Bye.
You too. Bye.
Bye.